builds the web shop.
So anyway, what's up for the next hour?
It's the new stuff with Brenno de Winter.
Okay, so we can just keep on talking himself. And wobbing until Brenno is here.
There's Brenno. Well,
actually, you're over the hour, so...
Oh, Brenno just told us he won't be here for another 2 hours.
Yeah.
He needs to go to the toilet badly.
Yeah, he needs to really, really, really take a leak. Oh, shit.
Shit, take a poop.
A leaky shit?
Yeah, a leaky shit.
Leaky stuff. Guys, we're actually over the hour, so I gotta cut you off.
Okay. Oh, we got kicked out.
Well, see you tomorrow.
Yeah, same time.
This was DieFest und Vla.de. Vlaonline.de.
Vla-strich online.de.
Bye bye, man. Bye bye.
Thing happening here, baby, or what? By that time, fast tapping with the night, he said it's time to blow, you know. So out the door we go, back to the ride. Steve inside in the lot, and off we drive. See, I hurt my lower lumbar, you know we never get far. Riding around in a stolen police car, so we dropped it off and piled in the caddy. Steve was driving, cause I had to talk to my man.
I don't know anything about any fucking setup. You can torture me all you want.
Torture you, that's good. That's a good idea. I like that one.
Running around.
Standing up straight, so we pull these jobs, make a little money. No one gets hurt if they don't act funny. On the way to the yacht, we almost got caught. Fast shooting mailboxes, know where the cops is, yeah. They got the Dunkin' Donuts adjacent from the former juice mailbox. Fast that just exploded. They gave chase from our man Steve's and Ace, and we lost those brothers with haste. We cast it off, and along we went off from Bermuda to an island resort. We rented.
Sunshine, need you cool. Are you cool?
And you're listening to Binary Voice. My name is Brenno de Winter, and this is the Hacker News Hour. Let's make a quick roundup of the news internationally. First off, pirates have been convicted in the Netherlands, and pirates that were near Somalia have been convicted to punishments up to 7 years in prison. Also in Dutch news is that currently there are rootkits that are fighting one another, which is, of course, only good news, actually. And a bug into a switch, a phone switch, takes down an entire hospital in the Netherlands. Talking about the quality of software. Right now, we are starting the show with Lodewijk van Zwieten and we are going to give him a call. So after this song, we'll talk about a public prosecutor, Lodewijk van Zwieten, and what he all does or shouldn't do, etc.
Hollow gold, her lips sweet surprise. Her hands are never cold. She's got Betty Davis eyes. She'll turn her music on you. You won't have to think twice. She's pure as New York snow. She got Betty Davis eyes. She'll unease you. All the better just to please you. She's precocious and she knows just what it takes to make a pro blush. She got Greta Garbo standoff style. She's got Betty Davis eyes. She'll let you take her home. She'll lay you on the throne. She got Betty Davis eyes. She'll take a tumble on you. Roll you like you were dice until you come out blue. She's got Betty Davis eyes.
Hallo?
Hello, Lodewijk van Zwieten.
Ja.
Hi. Lodewijk van Zwieten, you are cybercrime public prosecutor. What on earth is that?
I wonder what I'm doing myself some days. But no, I'm a public prosecutor first and foremost. It means that I'm responsible for the way that the police conduct their investigation. Both safeguarding the laws, making sure that they operate within the boundaries of the law, but also that they keep an open mind, keep an open view, as well for incriminating leads as leads that may acquit someone. So that's my responsibility as a prosecutor first and foremost. A prosecutor for cybercrime basically does that in cases of cybercrime. It's as easy as that. With cybercrime in general, I mean those criminal offenses in which ICT plays a key part. And I and my colleagues here at the National Prosecutor's Office in Rotterdam, we specialize in the high-end cybercrime, what we call the high-tech crime. And those are instances of cybercrime that are committed by criminal organizations that have the greatest technical difficulty of all cases that we encounter, that are strongly internationally oriented, and stuff like that, basically.
Oh, excellent! Yes, we agreed not to talk on any cases, but all the major cases that we've had in the Netherlands, basically, you have been the person running the case, right?
I have been involved, at least in some way, in those cases. I haven't done all those cases personally as a prosecutor, but since I'm responsible for the intake and the coordination of every case. Concerning high-tech crime here with the National Prosecutor's Office, I at least am connected with every case. That's right.
Yeah. What do you think of the hacker community? Like, they're here at the camp talking about technology. Should we all be arrested, or do you think it's cool?
I think it's extremely cool. rest assured that I'm as nerdy as the next guy. I have I wouldn't be able to do what I do without having a keen interest in technology and in computers.
Yeah, sometimes you still throw people in jail. I can remember people that were like in jail for 2 weeks. Recently, somebody was out of jail in 3 days. Why is that? How do you do that? I mean, is it like teasing or what is this?
No, it's not teasing. First, let me differentiate between, or at least go into the differentiation between what the hacker community likes to think of as hackers and crackers, because I'm very much aware that what the hacking community calls crackers are portrayed as or named as hackers in most media. That is not because we think that all hackers are bad. Far from that. I mean, I'm very much aware that the current state of technology couldn't exist without the hacker community and everything that they've done. And if you look at that all the CIOs or CEOs of all the major tech companies have a firm history in hacking, be it phone phreaking or be it other stuff, then I think it's very clear that hacking has played a major role in the development of modern technology. It's only that when you look at it from a moral viewpoint, originally, or in its very pure form, in its purest form, if you want to, hacking has everything to do with trying out new possibilities of technology, doing things with technology that technology was not designed for, exploring boundaries and things like that.
Well, when exploring boundaries, then basically, sometimes.
Sorry, Breno, we interrupt this program. This is anonymous. What a disgrace is it that this radio station features public prosecutor Ludwig van Zweden? Don't listen to this man. He is dangerous. And Breno, isn't he the one prosecuting you for the OV chip card case?
No, not really.
Well, I still think you should kick him off the show, or else we will have to keep listening to him. We wouldn't want to do that, right? Oh, and if you are talking to him, let him be nice to the Dutch lulls and be merciful. Please. I don't want to go to jail. Really. Please, please. Sniff, sniff, sniff. Back to you, Breno.
Well, sorry about that. You get hacked all the time, I guess. Lodewijk, we've had a range of attacks on all sorts of different sites. We've had data by lulls or whatever they are put on the internet, and like databases of dating sites. What is the big problem with this? I mean, the Justice Department is really going after that.
But well, the big problem with that is that organizations or groups or people that think that's the way to voice their discomfort with the way that big companies or governments are handling their privacy, those people then create a massive amount of collateral damage by making very personal data public from people who are customers from various organizations. They create, I think, a real danger for the persons, for the people whose information has been put on pastebin like that. I don't really buy the argument that if they didn't do anything with that information, somebody else would. I'm thinking that if you put private information, personal information on pastebin, you're going beyond what I think you should be doing to make your statement. And as a matter of fact, you're making it far more easy for persons who want to do anything criminal with those personal records to use them, because they don't have to hack into the systems themselves. You get it on a silver platter. All they have to do is keep an eye on PasteBin and
yes.
see if there's a phone that they can use there. So I'm thinking that it goes beyond the message that they're trying to convey, and I'm thinking that both from moral, but at least from a legal point of view, they firmly crossed the line there.
Yeah. Now, last week I had a scoop with a hacker calling himself Pompidompidom. And he disclosed, he didn't really disclose, but he showed that he could easily access a VIP list of famous Dutchmen and Belgians. Mm-hmm. We showed a couple of names in the media, but we didn't show addresses, phones, phone numbers, and email addresses. Is that more responsible? Is that still illegal, or is this the way to do it?
I mean, it's different with the press. I mean, the press at least have a solid moral code, have the notion of responsible disclosure, and that is something that you can hold them to, I'm thinking that as much as you would like to be able to be either anonymous or be totally free on the internet to do what you want, to say what you want, when it comes to those elemental rights that you claim, me being a lawyer, I would always argue, well, okay, you want to exercise those rights, but there's a limit to exercising those rights when you either hurt or violate the rights of others. I mean, we are living in a society with a lot of people. We all have to make sure that we don't bash our brains in every time that my neighbor does something that I wouldn't like him to do. We have to be able to coexist without resorting to violence or things like that. And freedom of speech or a lot of other freedoms, I think, have a limit in situations where exercising those rights hurt or infringe upon the rights of others.
Yeah. Now that's a very general answer. But if you see such an example as the one last week, you know, you mm-hmm. show basically proof, but you don't give all the details. If the anonymous people in the Netherlands were to do that, would your job be a lot easier or lighter? Or would you go after them still?
I think it would depend. I mean, because there's still a because apart from the disclosure, be it responsible or not, apart from the disclosure, there's also the way that you got your hands on that information, and that's another thing that I have to factor in. If it's a simple SQL query, so to speak, where the hacking or the cracking is fairly limited, then I'm thinking that we might be less inclined to go after those persons if the disclosure was responsible than if there was a very serious hack. Of course, I'm not saying here that we wouldn't do anything about it, or that everyone could commit SQL injections or things like that. But it does depend on the hack or the crack involved, I think.
Yeah, and of course also the relevance of the data.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, if it's very sensitive, or if it's state secret or confidential information, or if it's information that could immediately jeopardize the lives of people, then then there's an even greater moral responsibility, at least, to either not even commit that hack or be even more responsible with the disclosure. I mean, especially in the Netherlands, where we have quite some possibilities, I think, to ask for information from companies, from governments. That's not saying that they're all very eager to give up that information, but at least we have the possibilities, whereas in a lot of countries they don't.
Okay, turning the question totally around, those companies that are basically being exposed, they haven't taken security good seriously. Let's face it, if your easy SQL insertion can do this trick, then basically that is not sufficient security. That is not privacy friendly. Should those companies be prosecuted as well?
If there were a law stating that they would have to safeguard the information complying to certain security standards, then it might be so. Then I would have to prosecute them. But we don't have a law like that. I mean, basically implementing security measures in. Yes, should be part of doing your business, of committing good business, and it should be a part of caring for your customers. And I'm pretty sure that most companies do that, and most companies have the best interests of their customers in front of their minds. But I'm also thinking that a lot of companies aren't, at least at the management level, aren't aware of the dangers and aren't aware of the fact that they might be vulnerable. And overcoming those vulnerabilities is also going to cost money. And if you're in it for the money, then that's always going to be an issue.
Okay, one other question. A lot of people in the Netherlands and maybe in other countries think that the punishment in the Netherlands is basically like a Boy Scouts club. It's not all that stiff. What do you say to those people? Is the Netherlands punishing, or are the Netherlands punishing people, hackers?
Are we letting them off lightly, you mean?
Yes. Well, you know, it doesn't mean anything. You just go into the police station and you do a statement, and after 2 days you can go, and basically nothing will happen to you.
Well, that's not entirely true. I mean, I for one am thinking that we're doing a lot. It all depends if you believe in long sentencing. I'm very much aware that a fairly large share of the cracker community are minors, are teenagers. Doing this perhaps to get a kick, perhaps to show off to their friends, and that doesn't mean that I don't think that what they do isn't criminal behavior, because it can be, and it often is. But I mean, eventually everybody deserves a second chance, and of course, if the hack is serious enough, if the repercussions are serious enough, If the damages are high enough, then someone will deserve punishment for that. But whenever we arrest someone and whenever we release someone, I always say, well, the fact that we release someone after a couple of days doesn't mean that we don't think that the crime is serious. It all has to do with the fact that we, as a prosecution office, we cannot use pretrial detention as a sentence, so to speak. I always make the I draw a parallel with say an ice hockey game. If you make a foul in an ice hockey game, you get to go to the bench for a couple of minutes, and after that you get to go back in the game. But it doesn't mean that at the end of the game you don't risk a suspension for the next match. And basically, pretrial detention is that few minutes on the bench after which you can go back. And I can only keep someone in pretrial detention if there's serious unrest in society, if there's a genuine fear that when we release someone, he will go right back to committing crimes and things like that. But it doesn't say anything about the sentence that he can expect from a judge. So I try to keep those separated, and I understand that in the public eye, that separation is not always clear. It's hard to explain sometimes, because what we do is all about nuances. And if there's something that we've learned is that when you go public with a case, when you're being asked questions, where you go, well, not in this radio station, of course, but on other radio stations, then you don't always have the time to explain those nuances. And that is something that I'm always very eager to do. So I'm very happy that I got the opportunity here.
Yeah, I've got one last question, which is
sure.
Beyond any nuance at all. What was the coolest hack you ever did?
I didn't hack. Will you believe that? No, honestly, I've messed with computers of my entire family, up to the point where they wept because they had to throw out the hard disk or do a clean install. But no, I've done a lot of grief to people around me with my tinkering with computers, but I honestly haven't hacked.
Okay.
I've tinkered with radio and stuff like that, but I was never able to do things that they weren't meant to do. Well, apart from going up in smoke, perhaps, but
yeah. But then it's always the question: is that you who is to blame, or Microsoft?
Oh yeah,
Lodewijk van Swieten, you are a public prosecutor with the National Public Prosecutor Office in the Netherlands. Thank you so much for all your time and answering all these questions.
Sure, I was more than happy. Thank you for having me, Brenno.
Okay, bye-bye.
Okay, bye-bye.
and you're still listening to Binary Force 92.6 FM on your decked 1926, or of course signal.hackerspaces.org. My name is Brenno de Winter and you are listening to the news roundup. Earlier we talked to public prosecutor Lodewijk van Zwieten and he explained how a criminal investigation goes about. But the problem, of course, is that some of the evidence is so complex that it's hard to find. In that case, the Dutch Forensic Institute will do its job. Yesterday we played that interview already, but then the stream was down. Now the stream is up. We've got listeners. So here's the interview again with Erwin from the Dutch Forensic Institute. Erwin, you are with the Dutch Forensic Institute. You have built a tool to do some analysis on data that you recovered called Giraffe. Can you explain what that is?
Giraffe is a basically a tool that analyzes evidence, digital evidence. There are ordinary tools that can do that, tools like Ancase or FTK or the Sleuthkit by Dan Farmer. But these tools work on single images or a couple of images, and the average case at this point in time has a lot of images. We've had cases with as much as 50 or 60 different images from CDs, from hard disks, from floppies, you name it. And Giraffe enables us to search through all the images at the same time.
So you can search at the same time, and what can you search for? Can I type in child pornography and then all of a sudden there's all the child porn, or how should I see it?
You can search for child pornography, but you won't find much child pornography that way. A digest of known child pornography with the images we find inside the evidence, and these are marked as, we already know these. So you ask Giraffe, do you know any pictures from the child abuse database? And it says, yes, I know these.
Now that means that you work with checksums or something like that. What do you use?
Currently we use MD5 SHA-1 and SHA-256. And we are in the process of also including technology which does near image detection. So that means that if you have the big problem with hashes is that if I have a JPEG image from a raw image which is sent over an email, I have three copies of the same image, right?
Yes.
And I have three different digests, which means that I don't know that these three are the same. And near image detection does a comparison on the actual image, not the file, but the image, and says, these images are the same. And that's something we'd like to incorporate.
Now, one of the famous cases that currently came to you, and I'm not asking of insights on that case, but one of the famous cases is about a PDF file that was lost. And I'm one of the journalists that put a lot of effort in saying, like, well, some experts could better have a look at it. The NFV, the Dutch Forensic Institute, has been asked to look at the police. Would Giraffe be a tool that you could take to the police to check their systems?
No, it works the other way around. You take the pieces of evidence, or where you think the evidence is, whatever the suspected crime. I mean, we don't really care if it's child abuse or fraud or hacking or whatever. You take these pieces of evidence and you have the piece of evidence, you have them analyzed by Giraffe. And then you use Giraffe to search in the piece of evidence.
Yes.
So it's not like you can hook it up to a running system and let it do its magic on the running systems.
Okay, but in the case of finding, for instance, a PDF, you take all the images and then basically, for instance, just go by the name or whatever.
Yeah, for instance, yeah.
With Giraffe, I've once seen it at work, and you had an image of an iPhone.
Yeah.
And all of a sudden, I saw entire emails as a picture. How is that?
You saw email as a picture?
Yeah.
It renders the emails in the it looks at various levels inside of the evidence. So it looks at the file system, and it gets the files from the file system and the deleted files, and it says, this looks like a message store from Apple Mail, for instance. These look like images. And hey, wait a second, there's a zip file inside the email. There's a PDF inside the zip, inside the email, inside the mailbox on the file system.
And how many levels can you go deep?
Until it ends, basically.
Okay,
there's no fixed limit.
Hey, and how can people from probably police or Secret Service, how can they deliver the evidence? How does this work?
That works by SneakerNet or CarNet. They put the drives inside the car and bring them over to us, and we upload them to Giraffe.
Okay, and could somebody upload the data themselves?
There's no technical reason why they can't, other than lack of bandwidth, mostly on the police side.
Okay, and then CarNet is a lot quicker.
And the bandwidth of a car loaded with disk is quite high.
You're absolutely right there. Will Giraffe be open source?
I don't think so, and the reason for that is that we need money to fund more research, and most open source models work in a service way. You offer the service and you sell the services. We can't do that. We're not that kind of organization. So we need another way to basically monetize our ID.
Okay, and that would basically be through selling the service as a whole.
Yeah, and that's why we recently started cooperating with a Dutch company called Ansim, who's going to do the management of the
acquisition.
Yeah.
Hey Erwin, thank you so much for explaining all this.
Thank you.
And that was Erwin of the Dutch Forensic Institute talking about the tool Giraffe, where they can get all sorts of evidence. I've seen the tool myself, and one of the shocking parts of that tool is that they also can get some screenshots from iPhones. How does that work? Well, if you press your home button, basically what Apple does is make a screenshot of the content on the screen, and then make it smaller and smaller and smaller, crop it until you can't see it no more, and that gives this nice effect. But that image, of course, is stored in your cache and can thus be analyzed by law officials. And that basically means that if you're reading an email, press the home button, that basically that evidence will be stored, and sometimes indefinitely. So be very careful when using your iPhone. That is the lesson that I learned, and that is why I have an Android phone at the moment. It's time for some music, and I'm looking at my cool guy Xopar, who is running the show again. That was Binary Voice indeed, 92.6 FM. You're still listening to the news roundup. Interesting story out of the United Kingdom. The British Prime Minister David Cameron thinks that all the Twitter and Facebook is a problem for the riots, and that is being used in a wrong way. And he has said that the free flow of information sometimes can be a problem. And that, of course, is a very, very scary approach to freedom of speech, which unfortunately we have seen in the past before. A small incident in the Netherlands, well, not if it's you concerning you, but there has been a plane crash near Apeldoorn, a small village in the Netherlands. And probably it looks like that two people have died in that crash, but that is still very uncertain. Furthermore, the case that we've been talking about a lot, the Galaxy Tab and the Galaxy S, can they still be sold in the Netherlands and thus the rest of Europe? Apple has promised that they won't ask for a... how do you say that? It won't be forbidden if it's up to them until September 15, when the Dutch rules, when the Dutch judge rules. I start to stutter with this. And if it's related or not, but the Galaxy R, the cheaper phone than the Galaxy S2, will not come to the Netherlands. That has been said according towards NU.nl. And for all the stuttering, I think I need to catch a beer. So I'm going to ask Sopper if there's some music that we can play. When I think that I'm over you, I'm overpowered. Your data, my data. The chromosomes match. Exact as in matter, a matter of fact. These amorous feelings, a cognitive state, need the love object to reciprocate.
I'm over power. I mean, I think that I'm over. 4 days. A pretty flower in a vase, a slipper by the fireplace, a cello light in its case. Soon she's down the stairs, her morning elegance she wears. The sound of water makes her dream, awoken by a cloud of steam. She pours a daydream in a cup, a spoon of sugar sweetens up. And she fights for her life as she puts on a coat, as she fights for her life on the train. She looks at the rain as it pours, and she fights for her life as she goes in the store with a thought she has caught by a thread. She prays for the bread as she goes. Nobody knows.
And you're still listening to Binary Voice 92.6 FM, of course, on your stream or using your DECT 1926. In the studio is right now Gabrielle Komen, and she is an anthropologist, a professor from New York University. And you have been studying some ancient movement called Anonymous, Lulzsec, and all these things. Welcome to the show.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
Hey, and what is Anonymous? What is Lulzsec? What's the difference?
So one of the great things about defining Anonymous is that it's a little bit hard to define. But I guess we can start with saying it's some sort of political and protest movement, although its roots are not necessarily in protest movement, but in something called internet trolling. But since 2008, people have taken the name to protest things like censorship, copyright policies, and have also used the name to organize protest activities in support of WikiLeaks.
Okay, and that's of course where a lot of people know them from, because when Julian Assange was being prosecuted or faced the threat of prosecution, all of a sudden MasterCard website stopped working, Visa card website stopped working, and it was kind of serious.
Absolutely. That was in December in 2010. And this was a moment where WikiLeaks released a huge number of cables and a number of companies that were processing donations stopped doing so under sort of extra legal pressure. And from one day to the next, Anonymous helped to organize some very, very dramatic distributed denial of service attacks that took down a number of these websites. And that's really when they became quite publicly known outside of sort of geek and hacker circles.
Yes, and are they dangerous?
I don't quite think that they're dangerous. They definitely push the limits, sometimes legally, and in some other ways they are quite good at pushing certain buttons, you can say. And in the past few months, Anonymous have gotten more involved in hacking operations, not simply doing DDoSing nor providing technological assistance, but actually doing some hacking and leaking. And this obviously puts them in far more transgressive territory.
Yes. I've spoken to the Dutch public prosecutor who does cybercrime in the Netherlands just half an hour ago. And he said, like, well, if you do this, basically that means that you're affecting people that are totally innocent in a very harmful way. Do you agree with that?
I think it depends on the actual leak and the hack, but absolutely.
Well, if you talk a dating